Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to The Mentor, I'm Mike Boris. When Tim Fung wanted to be one of the first people to get his hands on the latest Apple iPad, he offered to pay a guy $1,000 to stand in line for him on City's George Street. The guy who said yes was a truck driver who became redundant the week before. Sure, it was a publicity stunt, but Tim created a job for this guy that had never existed before and would be the beginning of what would now be known as Airtasker. Tim Fung is CEO and one of the co-founders of Airtasker, a marketplace enabling users to outsource everyday tasks. Tim and his co-founder, Jonathan Liu, launched Airtasker back in 2012. And that was around the same time consumers were introduced to other marketplace companies such as Uber. Fast forward to this year, it has become a listed company on the ASX. Tim and I are going to discuss things to consider when pitching your idea correctly to your audience, and why storytelling can be the difference in closing a deal, how to develop a marketplace business, and balancing the buyers and sellers that use your marketplace. So let's get into it. Tim Fung, welcome to The Mentor.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
I've used Airtasker. I know a couple of my sons have used Airtasker. Things like for moving furniture and stuff like that, particularly when it comes to getting stuff up and down stairs where my boys live in apartments. So you're one of the co-founders of Airtasker, but I want to sort of wind it back a little bit. I want to talk about Tim Fung. Let's say you grew up in St. Ives, I think. Is that right, St. Ives?
That's right. Very fortunate to be, you know, born on the north shore of Sydney and in the quiet suburb of St. Ives Chase.
Your dad was from Hong Kong, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So he came to Australia when he was fairly young, about 15 years old. So I went to school here, and my mum is third generation Australian Chinese. So I think her family's been here since the 1800s. So
1800s.
Pretty long history in Australia.
Totally. That's about as Aussie as. And where'd you go to school up there, mate?
I went to St. Ives North, just to the public school, and then And then I went to Artarmon public school a bit later on.
Artarmon. Wow, that's a long way from St. Ives, though.
That's right. So as a 10-year-old jumping on the train up the North Shore, but they had the opportunity class at Artarmon. And so both my sisters went there. I went there as well.
And what did your dad do?
My dad was an accountant, but he was also a small business entrepreneur. He and a few of his mates had restaurants. One of them was a restaurant that was famous in the 90s called Jojo's Harborside, which I think got replaced with Jordan Seafood. But the original was my Uncle Joe's seafood restaurant. So, a few small businesses too.
And both your parents worked? Did mum work as well?
Yeah, she was a secretary. And again, always in small businesses, working for, entrepreneurs and, small businesses where it'd be a handful of people in an office, and so she was a bit of a jack of all trades.
Do you think you are the typical son of a Chinese immigrant on your dad's side and having that Chinese culture, albeit, like many, many generations back and on your mum's side? Do you think you have that sort of cultural bent towards being an entrepreneur, or do you think it's given your Chinese background? I mean, people say about Jewish people say about Greek people like me. Do you think you have that DNA or you will socialize that way, or do you think it's just a question of both your parents working hard and you just decided to get into it? Where do you think it sits?
Well, it's really interesting because I do think that, you know, my dad was always talking about business and entrepreneurship, you know, not in so many words when we were young, but he would talk about, you know, building your reputation and, you know, making sure that you're dealing with people in a way that is good for them and also good for you, which is essentially, you know, business talk. So I think it was definitely part of, you know, instilled into me growing up. I went to a public school. I went to North Sydney Boys in high school. There were a lot of people from different backgrounds there, a lot of people who were, you know, children of immigrants. And I would say that, you know, given that my parents came to, my father came to Australia when he was very young and my mum was a little bit more established in Australia, maybe my like culture and attitudes are slightly different because I found that, you know, a lot of the people who were children of more recent immigrants were much more risk averse and, you know, aiming to become doctors or, you know, like they aspired to much more like salary jobs and that's what their parents wanted them to do. And so I feel really fortunate to have been, you know, brought up on the North Shore and to be able to take a few more risks and have that opportunity, probably because I had a bit of a, you know, something to fall back on. Whereas I think, you know, if your parents were recent immigrants, maybe you didn't have that sort of privilege and luxury. So pretty thankful for that.
That's a good analysis, actually, because my father was, I'm a first generation of an immigrant and, or immigrants. And you're right, we didn't have much, we had nothing to fall back on. So they made us, myself and brother and sister, all go into professions. And we'll, you know, the deal was you had to study hard, you had to go to university, you had to get a degree, you had to get a profession. Well, not a compulsory thing, but it was like, you know, driving towards that the whole time. And it is quite conservative. It's a conservative way of doing things. But equally, I saw my dad always having a crack trying to do other things other than being a factory worker, trying to get forward because he was uneducated. So, you know, he couldn't really go into a profession, never went to school. So I guess, yeah, that's, but your analysis is quite a good one. I never thought of that way because people look at like, you know, boys and girls of Chinese descent who get into a selective school by the sound of it in North Sydney as being kids that are driven to study, they have access to tutors, blah, 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 you know, like, I mean, that was my generation. Your generation is my generation 30 years before that. So, yeah. You know, my generation was very few Chinese around. It was mostly Greeks and kids of Jewish descent, Italians, some Lebanese, et cetera. And when we got on university, it was because everyone took the view that we were pushed. Now we look at not so much your generation, but, you know, young Chinese kids today who get into university, yeah. And, you know, like they're all in the selective schools. They do really well at university. They get into the best, the hardest degrees to get into because their parents push them. And I've always wondered whether or not I'm talking to someone like you, would you say that's a proper stereotype? I mean, and is it driven from the fact that, and I think it's driven from a good place, but you think it's driven from the fact that parents push their kids to do better than they have, to take advantage of the opportunities that a great country like Australia offers?
Yeah, I think there's a combination. You know, you mentioned like Jewish folks and some of the other cultures are pretty driven by education and entrepreneurship and things like that. And I think there must be some aspects of that that, you know, are sort of like longstanding, you know, cultural aspects that stay ingrained in any kind of group of people. But in terms of Australia and, you know, immigration into Australia, it definitely does feel like, you know, when I was younger, those stereotypes were probably true. Most of the immigrants were very recent immigrants. A lot of it was like, you know, you need to work hard at school because, you know, I didn't have the opportunity that I'm giving you. And so you need to make the most of it and to de-risk that, you know, de-risk being successful. You know, just make sure that, you know, you get into uni and things go well in that sense. But I think what you are starting to see is like that culture sort of shifting over time. You know, if you think as people are more longstanding and developed in the country, for example, if you look at like in the US now, you know, Silicon Valley, entrepreneurs, I think from Asian and Indian backgrounds are a huge proportion of the successful entrepreneurs are from backgrounds like that. And probably because those groups are getting a little bit more established in the US, whereas there are probably other groups that maybe don't have that, you know, opportunity just yet.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see it like, and I don't want to labor it, but I sort of see it like Gold Rush. You know, Silicon Valley is a gold rush in a new format. You know, when the gold rush was on in Australia, the immigrants came from everywhere to try and make a better life. And Silicon Valley just represents that. It's another gold rush But just a different format. Formatting is different. A bit like what Airtasker does. It's a marketplace, but just different formatting, you know, like using technology.
Yeah.
So I read somewhere that your dad used to pay you or encourage you by paying you to pluck out silver hairs or something like that when you're a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So he used to pay me a couple of cents per hair that I'd pull out of his head. I don't know. It's kind of it feels like a very fruitless exercise. I don't even know how many hairs you have on your head, probably millions, but I would just sit there and pluck hairs out of his head. And usually I'd get paid a couple of cents per hair that I pulled out. But you know, from time to time, I was able to make a bit of money out of it by negotiating with him for higher rates.
That's a good way. It's sort of a shared event too, by the way, because I can imagine, I don't know, but I would imagine pulling hairs out of your head's not that, probably not painful, but it wouldn't be all that much fun. So you went to school, you went after the North Sydney school, you went to university. Which university did you go to?
I went to UNSW, and so University of New South Wales.
Yep.
And I did a degree, which was pretty unique at the time because I didn't really plan out what I wanted to do in uni. But I saw that there was this course, which was a Bachelor of Commerce, Marketing, Tourism and Hospitality Management. And I thought that just sounded cool. I was just like, oh, be in hospitality, you know, hang out at cool hotels and serve drinks and, you know, that sort of thing. So I went and did that degree. And thankfully, it was a Bachelor of Commerce. That was the backbone. But the degree in hospitality management was really awesome. I did really well in the wine tasting course that we had to do.
So to get a BCom at UNSW in the Australian School of Business is pretty difficult for those who are listening. I don't know, you must have been a 98% or something like that around that territory.
Yeah, I did pretty well in the HSC. I actually pushed really hard during, you know, year 11, year 12 to do well. But actually, I think for a Bachelor of Commerce, it was around about a 96 UAI at the time that you needed, or ATAR. Actually, with the hospitality degree, they actually had another layer, which was like doing, you know, personal, interpersonal skills tests and things like that. And so you could actually get in there with a lower ATAR.
Right, okay. Well, because I'm still have an academic role out there in the Australian School of Business. I'm still a professor out there in that school. And funny, I haven't lectured there for a couple of years, but like last time I lectured there, I remember it was usually at night. And like half of them would fall asleep in my lecture. They'd be sitting there dozing off, and I would ask them why. And most of them, the reason they told me is because they're up the night before working at Woolworths packing shelves. You know, like a lot of them had part-time jobs. So really driven young people do that degree, particularly in the master's degree. You sound like you've gone into your degree sort of with a little bit of a lifestyle sort of flavor towards it, thinking to yourself, hang on, I could be on the P&O cruiser with Captain Stubbing sort of serving wine and talking to all the guests. Is that something that was going through your head?
Yeah, that's actually right. It's funny. I feel like in life I've generally gone through waves of, you know, being really conscientious and then, you know, having breaks and then being conscientious again and then taking breaks. So during high school in the early days, I was working really, really hard. I think in my sort of mid years, I didn't do so well. And then, you know, during year 11 and 12, I pushed myself really hard. At the end of that, I said to myself that during uni, I was going to enjoy university. Like this was just, you know, it was a pass fail sort of thing for me. And I wanted to, you know, take a break and enjoy it. And so, you know, I passed all of my courses and did okay. But, you know, I wasn't a rock star university student. And then, you know, coming out into work, worked really hard and then taking breaks. And, you know, obviously with doing what I'm doing now at Airtasker, that's something we're really, really pushing hard right now. And at some point in the future, it would be great to be able to create some space and have a bit of a break.
And that's interesting. And that's a good perspective because I think that most of our audience and people who aspire to do what you're doing have a view on entrepreneurs like you, that you are endless in your energy, that you never stop, you push for your whole life, you know, you never have a break. And I know people think that about me, and it's just not the case. It's interesting you're now, you know, you're putting out there that you go hard when the opportunity's there. And for me, that's what I do. When the opportunity's there, I go hard and I just take everything off the table. It doesn't matter what's on the table. I'm going to work my ass off to take everything off the table. But once everything's off the table, like if I can get it, I can easily be distracted in relation to something else, some of the thing that sort of takes my interest. It doesn't have to be business. It can be something else. I can go about that as something else in a business-like manner. So what you're sort of saying that, you know, you go in, you're not drifting in, drifting out, but you go hard when the time is right to go hard but the other times you know when to take yourself a break. And I think it's really important. What do you think about that, giving yourself a break?
Yeah, I read a book recently, Why We Sleep, which is a book by Matt Walker about the science of sleep. And it was actually sort of like mind shaping for me, this book, because the way that this professor of sleep talks about sleep, he talks about it in the active sense, that it's actually something that you need to do to recover your body. And that it's kind of crazy that, you know, entrepreneurs and students and, you know, people and even society at large, the way it's structured, it sort of makes it aspirational to just keep going and going and going. And what he likens it to is like, you know, it's like running a marathon. Like there's no way you're going to get from, you know, travel 1,000 kilometers. There's no way that the best way to do that is just to keep running forever. You need to take those active breaks. And it makes it really clear that, you know, your body needs to recover so that you can go hard again. You know, you can apply that same thing to your mind as well. You need to sleep and take a break. And it's actually a really smart thing to do to, you know, sometimes rather than, you know, writing emails at 2 a.m. in the morning, is rather take a break, step back, figure out what's important. And then when you wake up at 9 a.m. in the morning, like a normal person, or 8 a.m. in the morning, you can really do that work much more efficiently and well. And I think you got to balance that. It doesn't mean that you can just, you know, sometimes you do have to answer that email at 1 a.m. in the morning sometimes. But actually, as a general principle, it's smarter to think smarter, take breaks, and then do things properly. And I think Jeff Bezos is pretty famous for that. I think he sleeps like 9 hours a night or something. But, you know, when he's awake and making decisions, he's making bloody good decisions as opposed to making them, you know, half-baked.
I'm really glad we've raised this because I think it's an important point. We need to debunk the myth. The myth is that Churchill would have, you know, 3 hours sleep a night and sleep an hour during the day, something like that. Einstein, you know, would only need 4 hours sleep. And I think that, that's what's written about him. I don't know whether it's true or not. I thought it's going to be pretty hard to prove it one way or the other now. And a lot of people look at entrepreneurs like you and they say, well, I've got to be like that and I've got to work till midnight every night. I can survive on 4 or 5 hours. I can get up at 5 and I can go again. I can just keep doing it. Eventually, you'll get burnt out. I don't give a shit who you are. You will. I've experienced it. It's actually happened to me. It took me a long time to learn this stuff, by the way, like really long time to get my head around it, because sometimes I overdo it. And what I tend to find is that when I'm overdoing, I'm turning shit at work out anyway. It's not all that good. It's not that effective. And it's good to see, relatively speaking, a young guy, relative to me, like you, actually expressing it this way. And I think that other entrepreneurs need to get their head around this. You've got to do it. You might, as you say, you might be times you get to stay up to midnight, you've got to stay at 1 or 2 because you're on a roll. You've got to keep going. But don't make that part of your regime, that I do go to bed at 1 o'clock every morning, every night, and that when I am, and then I get up again at 6 a.m. because that's, you're going to burn yourself out. And not only do we need to have enough sleep during the day, but we actually need to take a break every year or every 6 months. Everybody's different, but just appreciate what it is you need to do and how you break and where you break and what is your break. When I take a break, I actually come back so much better, only like 3 or 4 days, but I come back so energized. It's crazy. I've gone through a process, Tim, where I've actually run myself into the ground and I've had a major immune response where my whole body's just seized up, and then I'm out for fucking 2 weeks. So I think that's a really important point.
Definitely, yeah. I've kind of noticed there's almost like a few different cycles there. I think it's almost like you need to be taking like daily breaks, you know, like sleeping well. Generally, you need to take those, you know, as you mentioned, those 3 day weekends from time to time, and those can be really powerful. Every kind of 8 weeks or every quarter or something. But then for me, I also feel like having 2 weeks, like a block where you actually get your head out of work and you actually try and think about something else. And, you know, sometimes it's related to work. I won't lie. Like it's always around. But, you know, sometimes taking that 2 weeks out, like for me, I do that over Christmas usually. And when you come back, you are just, you know, you're moving at the next level. And so, yeah, I feel like there's almost like breaks that need to be taken at all those different sort of cycles, daily, quarterly, and probably yearly too. But everybody's different.
Yeah, but they've got to work out their own routine and their own rhythm. And I think it's really important. Just don't think that people like you or me or others are, you know, working 20 hours of every day or 18 hours of every day, every day of the week, every week of the year for years. It just doesn't happen. After your university, where'd you first land a job?
So I was actually during university working at a really small boutique hotel in the eastern suburbs called the Altamont Hotel.
It was, I know that one.
Yeah, it was owned by a man named Paul Fishman, who at the time was 27 years old, a really young entrepreneur. And I was like sort of 20 at the time, I think. And I didn't know this, but Paul, you know, he went on whilst I was working there to buy the hotel next door. And then he went, bought the hotel next door to that. Then
he owned Eight Hotels, a group called Eight Hotels or something, didn't he?
That's right. And now I think he's got something like 40 hotels across different countries and things like that. And I was so fortunate to have been there on the ground level when he had like literally just scraped enough money together to buy this first hotel. So I was working there, and then some really exciting people used to come through the door, like little Australian celebrities and things like that. So it was a really cool place to work during uni.
Yeah, that's cool. So and you learn from Fishman sort of the art of taking risk, I guess.
Yeah, I learned a lot from Paul, but also I learned how to work 12 hours continuously at the hotel, doing basically everything from the housekeeping to putting out breakfast to taking bookings and doing guest showing. So it was really good, like just do whatever it takes sort of role. Whilst I was there, a job opportunity came up on the UNSW jobs board. And basically it said that you get the opportunity to work with Steve Waugh, all these like Greg Norman and all of these like sports people. I thought that sounded pretty cool. And so I applied for this internship. It was an unpaid internship. And it turned out it was actually with Macquarie Bank, because at the time Macquarie was working closely with Greg Norman to build golf course real estate developments, and working with Steve Waugh to build Indian cricket real estate plates. And so I applied for that, and I got that internship, and then that turned into my first job out of uni, working in real estate investment banking at Macquarie.
And why don't you tell us what it's like to work in the millionaire's factory at Macquarie Bank? I mean, especially as a young intern, not getting paid.
It was definitely, you know, they weren't really prescribed to the get a bunch of sleep motto. It was a different working style there. And I think I feel so fortunate to have been able to work there during, you know, what turned out to be a massive property boom. So I guess when you talk about the millionaire's factory, it was definitely did feel like that at the time. The parties were definitely pretty awesome. You know, some of the people that I was working with, you know, were on an awesome run. But the opportunity was amazing. The skills that you learn in a place like that, I think, are really powerful, like in terms of things like quant and analytics and things like that. Yeah, I look back at a culture like that, and although, you know, there's lots to criticize about a culture that works people, you know, on weekends till 2 a.m. and things like that, it is a real culture. You know, they've really got a way of doing things, and it's a high-performance way of doing things, and I have a lot of respect for that. And I think there's lots to be learned from that when you're building out your own organization. Maybe you don't want to do the 2 a.m. On weekends part of it, but, you know, being able to inspire people and motivate them to work at that level is a pretty powerful thing.
It's probably interesting too. A lot of times it's not because you have to work to 2 a.m. It's because everyone else is working at 2 a.m. and you look around you, the team's all just putting in. I mean, I was in partnership with Macquarie Bank for a long time, and it's a very interesting culture. It sounds like they enslave you to some extent, but they don't. It's actually, from my experience anyway, everybody actually wants to do what they do. You probably can't do it forever.
For sure.
But you do what you want to do. And even if you're not getting paid, you do it because you want to be part of that outcome. You want to be part of that, as you said, high-performance success, and success that comes from high performance. That's an important thing to learn if you want to become a good entrepreneur, and also learning how to, when you become an entrepreneur and you have people working in your own shop, like your shop, how do I take a little bit of that and try and parlay that into my own business and have my people want to work at high performance levels and do it in a way that I don't force them, but they're actually wanting to do it themselves for their own CV.
Definitely. It feels like a team sport, you know, when you're working in a place like that. And that's something that, you know, is something that I want to build at Airtasks as well, like make people feel part of something and give that recognition and that reward when people smash it out of the park. And I think that's actually more valuable than the money. You know, I think at a place like Macquarie, obviously the money is a perk for everyone, but I don't really think that was, you know, directly what people wanted. Like people, you know, they don't really love buying lots of stuff. It's actually the fact that when you're winning, it's a bit of a score, and, you know, you feel like you're part of that high performance team that's winning. That's a really cool feeling.
And you're like, that's a big deal. So, and post Macquarie?
Also, actually after Macquarie, I I joined a fashion modeling agency called Chic Management. So it was interesting, I guess, again, the allure of like celebrities and stuff like that. I'm really into Formula One, and I wanted to learn how to like manage talent and help drivers become successful. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go try and be like Ari Gold from Entourage, go and work at a talent rep agency. And so I applied to work at a place called Chic Management. Ursula Hufnagel is the co-founder and, you know, a former model. And she gave me an opportunity to work with her, which was amazing. Again, I did that for free to start out. When I worked there, you know, she looked after people like Miranda Kerr and a bunch of other Australian supermodels and things. That led me, I guess, to working in entrepreneurship, because the co-founder of the agency, the other half of the agency, was a man named Peter O'Connell, who is one of the founding directors of Optus. And I just met him randomly at a work event whilst I was working at Chic. And he was like, oh, I've never had like an investment banking analyst working in my modeling agency before. And, you know, I'm going to go do some entrepreneurial stuff. Do you want to come and help me? So really fortunate to be taken under his wing and given an opportunity to work on a startup. And, you know, the first big one that we worked on was a company called Amazim, which is like a mobile virtual network operator. We started that at the back of the modeling agency. And yeah, again, just really fortunate to have gone on a journey where I got to learn from, you know, an awesome founder like Peter and the other founders of Amazim.
Peter's a great guy. He was the CEO at CPH, Consolidated Press Holdings, for Kerry Packer for many years, or for the Packer family. I knew him from those days. I've known him for a long time. I remember when he first started Amazim, and I thought, oh my God, you're going to put up a competitor to everyone else out there. And I don't remember how long ago, it was maybe 10 years ago or so, but maybe even longer. But he's such a goer, and he's very smart, and he's incredibly connected. I was amazed at how he was able to raise money. As I recall, he raised money out of Europe. I mean, there were some big European investors in Amazim originally. Did you learn anything about raising money? Because obviously Airtasker has had to raise money. What did you learn in terms of pitch, connections, raising money?
Oh, so I was, again, like being Pete's sidekick in those early days. I got to go there. Yeah, I basically designed all the pitch decks and had to do all the work behind the pitch. So that was like an awesome experience. And I think it was really hard to raise that money. We had to go and, you know, pitch to a lot of people across the world to be able to bring that financing in. One thing that Pete did teach me along that journey was just really thinking about things like end to end, like every little detail. I remember we went and pitched a group of folks at a hotel. You know, we booked out a hotel meeting room and to do the pitch, and there was no screen that was sort of built into the room. And so we couldn't actually put up the pitch deck, and we ended up having to just do it off a laptop. And, you know, Pete kind of scolded me after the meeting, going like, where was the overhead, where was the projector? Like, why didn't you bring a projector to the meeting? I was like, I wouldn't have thought that you need to bring like a large screen projector to a meeting at a hotel. He's like, well, like, how are you going to present it to them if you don't have that? And I think the lesson there was like, you need to be thinking about all of those details end to end and just imagine, you know, how the meeting's going to go and make sure you're covering off all of those details, no matter how small they are. So yeah, I learned a lot from Pete throughout, you know, raising that capital. And that did help us for Airtasker.
Pete is an incredibly convincing character. He's a very good presenter. Like, obviously he's got to know his stuff, but he's very good in front of people. You would agree, but I'm just getting that sense from you now too, that you're quite competent at presenting, discussion, you know, when to time your sentences, when to stop, you know, and like a lot of people think, oh, the pitch is the pitch. It's not just the pitch. It's about the tone, the timing, and you've got to sort of read into the situation all the time. It's also about all those various points that you raised before, about making sure you've got overhead projector if you're in a hotel and et cetera. All the little bits, all the weeds, they're all going to be there. If you reflect on Peter, and I'm sure, you know, I haven't seen him for a while, but I was good friends with him many years ago. What would you say that you learned from him in terms of his ability to pitch to his audience in terms of raising money?
Well, I think Pete is an incredible storyteller, and I've been, you know, learning about this over the years and trying to improve this as well, which is to sort of step back and start back with the problem, anchor back to something that, you know, your audience and yourself both empathize with, and then sort of go on that journey towards getting towards a solution. I think the one thing that can be quite, you know, this applies in almost all forms of communication. It can be very jarring when somebody just comes into a room and throws a solution into the room and says, here it is, I've got the answers. Usually that doesn't resonate with people because they haven't been on the journey that you've been on. So better is to sort of take a step back, anchor back to something that both you and the audience sort of empathize with and can understand, and then sort of like step by step, take them towards the solution that you're proposing. So in the case of, you know, a mason, it might have been something like, you know how it's really annoying that your phone bill, you get bill shock, and, you know, when you open up that bill and it's a $1,000 phone bill and that really hurts, you know, people go, yes. It's like, well, we're developing a solution to try and, you know, remove that from the world. And then this is what a mason is. So I think, you know, Pete does that incredibly well. He probably takes it to the next level where he can do it in poetry and soliloquies and haikus and things like that as well. He's a brilliant sort of literature, you know, expert. But I think, you know, he always had that ability to be able to empathize with problems that the other, you know, that the audience is going to resonate with.
He knows how to control the room. He's nearly like a like someone in the old bard or a poet or something, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. He controlled the whole room and he plays every character. And he's very good. I was surprised when he raised all the money, but good on him. Well done. And brilliant that you got an opportunity to be with these sorts of people like Peter O'Connell. What happened after a mason?
One of my uni mates, Jono, who was a telco engineer that I brought into Amazim, he and I were the first one and two employees of Amazim. Once the company had launched, we'd raised the money. We'd gone through this mad rush of hiring about 200 people, building an office, scaling the marketing, et cetera. About 6 months into it, you know, we were already starting to get itchy feet around, like, what's next? Jono and I used to meet up in the coffee room every morning and just talk about our different ideas. We had a couple of different ideas. One of them was a terrible one that I'm very glad that we didn't go through with, but it was like a QR code marketing company, which is a terrible idea. But then I was living in the city at the time with a bunch of other guys in an apartment in Elizabeth Street. And I asked one of my friends to help me move apartments. You know, the reason why I asked him to come and help me move is because he's got this truck that he uses to do deliveries. He runs a business making chicken nuggets, frozen chicken nuggets, which he, you know, sells wholesale. So we put everything in the back of his truck and he helped me move apartments. And that just got us thinking is, why don't we ask our friends and family to do all these kinds of jobs when there's so many people out there looking for a way to be able to earn money? Like, it's just crazy. And you're asking someone to come and help you move who's clearly very busy, has better things to do. And yet that's a better opportunity or an easier way to get things done than like going and finding someone who actually wants to do that job. And we just saw that this was so broken and that, you know, if we could just connect these two groups up in a trusted way, we'd be able to create a whole bunch of opportunity. And so that was the genesis for Airtasker.
You actually had a real need yourself and you experienced the need and you thought you could come up with a solution. That brings us to Airtasker. We're going to go to the break. But when we come back from the break, I actually want to ask you, I mean, it's okay to have a good idea, a great idea, but it's not just about that. It's about the execution. It's about raising capital, patient capital at that. And it's about deploying. What were your trials and tribulations and, you know, how did you conquer those things? Right through to the listing, the IPO. So let's go to the break and we'll come straight back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So back from the break, I'm here with Tim Fung, and Tim is the one of the founders of Airtasker. We've sort of travelled from early days up to Airtasker being a great idea. What I want to find out is, you know, you have a great idea, what's the first thing you do?
Yeah, it's really interesting. We sort of had that genesis, that spark of the idea in probably about May of 2011, and we didn't react to it too quickly. We actually just started, you know, just talking about it. You know, we were still in our 20s at the time, so we'd go out and have beers with our friends and just talk about stuff. I remember pitching it to two people. One person was a business consultant that I knew who went on to do great things at Google and a bunch of other places. And he asked a few of his friends at Bain whether they would use a service like Airtasker. And they were like, hell yeah. So that was kind of like tick in the box number one. The second person I pitched it to was the person that I ended up moving in with. You know, after the apartment move, I moved in with another roommate. He worked in superannuation. And so he was like quite risk averse, I would say. Like generally, he's approached things very cynical and he'd be like, that's a crap idea. And like that was the default response to stuff. And this was probably the first idea that I pitched to him where he didn't sort of, you know, completely smash me. He was actually like, it's not that bad. And I was like, wow, that's a positive signal. Yeah, after pitching it to those few people, I guess that got me interested in actually, you know, exploring this idea. And the first thing that I did was I just had a sketch pad out and I just started like wireframing up, you know, a vision for what we wanted to build, coming up with a brand name and I guess just going about and doing it. You know, figuring out, laying the path as we went. And I think that is probably one aspect that is, you know, of typical founders, which is that if you think about it too much and you try to plan it out too much, most of the time you convince yourself it's a crap idea and, you know, or it's not worth it. The risks aren't worth it. The probability is not worth it. And you don't go and do anything about it. Sort of jumping off the cliff, if you will, and then, you know, forcing yourself into a position where you got to figure it out along the way was sort of the way that we did it. And I think if I had sat down and planned out what the next 10 years were going to look like since then, you know, probably wouldn't have started in the first place.
Was Airtasker the name you first came up with?
No, we had tons of other really, really terrible names along the way before we got to Airtasker.
How did you get that name?
It's actually related to, well, sorry, maybe I just start back from where our head was at. One of the things that we wanted to really differentiate with Airtasker is that we wanted to make tasking on our platform something aspirational. We felt it was really important that you treat people in a way in which they're actually inspired to do the work. And we believe that every single person has skills. And so we kind of imagined Airtaskers or people doing work on the platform as people who were sort of like bounding across the city, you know, jumping from building to building, helping people out along the way. There's actually a character from Marvel, like a Marvel comic called the Airwalker. He's like this really tough looking character who has like flaming shoes and jumping around and flying around and things like that. And we're like, yes, we want to be like that. But then like we needed Task to be the name. So we just changed Airwalker and took out Walk and replaced it with Task. And that's how we ended up with Airtasker.
How cool. But that's pretty cool though. It's a good story. And it's sort of quite an interesting, well, the fact is there is a story with it and there's logic there too. So it's quite an interesting way of arriving at the name. So you've got the name and then you've got your purpose, you know, the reason what you want people to feel inspired. And but what's the next thing? Like someone's got to build the platform. Someone's got to do the technology. Who'd you turn to? How'd you do that?
Well, one of the things about building out a marketplace is that it's not just building a website or like, you know, just building some small application and then, you know, trying to sell widgets along the way. When you build a marketplace, it's actually more akin to building out like infrastructure. It's almost similar to building out a telco or a road network or something like that, because it literally has no value on day one unless you build up the connections in your marketplace and you build up that liquidity. It's not something that you can kind of go into in a half-baked kind of way. So the first thing that Jotto and I did is we quit our jobs at Amazon. So we let Pete and the other founders of Amazon know that we were going to quit and go do something else. And I literally do remember a day that we went down to Aussie Square, Australia Square, and we sat there having a beer. We're like, are we going to do this? And then we said, yes, we're going to do this. And, you know, we did our fist bump and said, like, this is the commitment. Jono was an engineer and a pretty talented product guy. So he started writing up all the specs, but he's not a developer. So we had to go and find a group of people to help us build the software. We had worked with a lot of different agencies when we were building the Amazin platform, but we knew that that wasn't going to be a fit for building out a startup. And so we met a person called Michael Chindrick, who runs Sentia, which sounds like a big agency, but it was actually like this at the time, this small group of, you know, smelly people who were kind of sitting in an office in above George Street near Town Hall Station in this like really small office. And we walked in, but they had this really cool fish tank and they had like Street Fighter on the arcade machine and like a racing car chair and stuff. We're just like, this is awesome. Like, these are the kinds of people we want to work with. So we sort of did a quick assessment with them, but we worked with them in a different way, which is that we pretty much engaged them as like our team and we would go sit in their office next to the Street Fighter machine and work with them side by side, literally building it out pixel by pixel. That turned out to be a great partnership. So that continued on for quite a number of years before we really invested into building out Airtasker's software engineering culture.
How'd you pay them though? Where did the money come from?
John and I put in a bunch of our own money to be able to get the thing started. Thankfully, Pete and a couple of the Amazin founders, although they were pretty miffed that we had, you know, quit our jobs at Amazin, they put in a little bit of money as well, which was, you know, great signaling for us. And then we actually gave Michael, the founder of Sentia, a bunch of equity, you know, sweetened the deal. And I think he's pretty happy with how that went in the end.
Where is that now? Because, you know, like a lot of people I know who come up with these great ideas and they actually can do some of the work, they can get it to a certain stage, but they do need to then go and find the specialist to, you know, like in your case, build the technology. But they don't like to give equity away and but at the same time, they can't afford to pay. They struggle with how they're going to go forward. And then what they tend to do is go and find someone who can do it cheaper and they just drip feed it. Time to market is important. You could have actually said, listen, why don't we slow the pace down and we'll pay you what we can afford. Was there a point at which you said, no, hang on, we need to get to the market quickly. What we're better off doing is doing an equity deal and paying them something. I mean, did you go through that process, getting to market fast?
We always wanted to build something big and have impact, like genuinely subscribe to that philosophy of, you know, smaller slice of a bigger pie. And I think that is something also that, you know, Pete really instilled in me as well, which is like, bring other people on the journey. Like, it's going to be so much better if you're working as a group and you're all anchored towards wanting the same thing. And so, you know, giving away equity was something that, you know, didn't really faze me too much at all. I actually wanted to bring people on that journey and found it was a really great thing to be able to do. And I think also like one reason why a lot of entrepreneurs want to like hold on to a lot of equity is to hold on to control, you know, to be able to still have influence over the company. And I think that's valid. But I think you can earn that influence in different ways. You know, a lot of these Silicon Valley companies have these sort of ownership structures where it's like the founders have 1,000-to-1, you know, voting rights over ordinary shareholders and things like that. And we don't have that at Airtasker. We always had ordinary shares where my vote was just as important as somebody else's. That holds you to a high level of account in terms of actually making decisions that, you know, inspire the trust of other people, that make other people say, yeah, I want to trust this person as the CEO and the founder of the company because they're making decisions which are good for all of us.
You're there making those calls, not because you got 1,000 times their votes and they got no choice, but you're there making those decisions because they want you there because they have confidence in your capacity. And I think that's a really important point. You raised, did you raise like $1.5 million, $2 million to kick it off? I mean, like with Pete and everybody?
Yeah, so we raised about 250K just to get it started, of which Jono and I put in a big chunk of that 250K. And that was literally just to say, hey, we're serious about this. We've actually built the platform. We are out in market. This is happening. But we knew that as soon as we got out to market that we needed to raise more money. And I got some advice from another actual ex-Packer executive ago, a man named Gary Sladen, who said to me, you know, when you're drilling for oil, he's like, the best time to raise money is before you actually start drilling. Once you start drilling, then the pressure's really on. People either get a number and it's sort of like hit or miss. So he said, as soon as you build this platform, you should go out and raise the next round. So we did that and we raised about $1.5 million. And that was largely off the back of the trust that we built, Jono and I, in being part of the Amazin journey. Like, people had seen that we could execute on something before. For about 5 seconds there, I thought that we were flush. I was like, this is awesome, $1.5 million. I've never seen this much money in a bank account, which I control before. we're on top of the world. But as soon as, you know, you start hiring people and you start seeing the costs add up, it quickly becomes incredibly daunting. And I remember in probably month three or four, once we'd hired a team, started, you know, spending a little bit of money on advertising and PR and things like that, we had a burn rate of like 120 grand or something in like month three or four.
A month.
And when you see that next to $1.5 million, which is kind of going down very, very rapidly, things start to get very, very real. And I would say it was mostly a sense of fear and anxiety as opposed to a sense of empowerment.
Well, you go from the penthouse to the shithouse really quickly.
That's right.
I mean, like, you got the $1.5 million, you're feeling, how good is this? Like, that's a lot of dough, and we can do everything we need to do. And all of a sudden, you know, 8 months later, you think, shit, it's only going to last another 4 months. I'm in
That's
trouble
right.
here. And Kerry Packer once said to me, he said, a bit like what Gary Sladen said to you, always raise the money when you don't need it. He said, you can rest assured the day you need the money, you won't be able to raise it.
Mm.
And there's a thing, investors can smell if you need something. And they either ping you on the value of what it is you're raising against. In other words, they discount you. Or alternatively, they just walk away altogether. And you're right, you're better off to raise a dough and when you've got something nice and shiny, because it can be pretty daunting, but you've got to make sure you raise enough. So what did you do? It's like you got a run rate of maybe 4 more months. Now, was that technological scale or was it to market, to build scale?
It was really interesting. As a marketplace company, the product that we're building is a combination of two things. It's one, building out the tech stack, you know, the software that powers the market. But it's also about building out liquidity in the marketplace, the buyers and the sellers, or in our case, the customers and the service providers. We had to do both of those different things. And the way that we pitched the outcomes that we were aiming for was in terms of like marketplace traction. You know, we said, this is how many users we want to get to. This is how many transactions we think we can get to. But we were pretty clear that when you're building a marketplace, it's likely that you're going to be investing for some time to come. You know, this isn't the last round of funding that we're going to be doing. We're going to, you know, be on that trail for a while. And so that pretty much was the next sort of 18 months. Every 12 to 18 months, we'd have to be out to market raising new money and showing the progress that we were making. And along that first sort of 7 or 8 years, even though revenues were going up, burn rates were definitely going up as well. So, you know, the stakes were kind of building up over time. In the early days, we were burning maybe 100K a month. 7 or 8 years in, we were burning $2 million a month. So it was pretty, the stakes were increasing over time and it was pretty heavy.
One of the things I know about you guys is the Seven Group invested in you. Was that a transaction to try and like some financial engineering to buy cheaper at Seven and get advertising on Channel 7? Because I do remember seeing a lot of Airtasker ads on Channel 7 for many, many years. I still see them today, but just assume that you'd done a sort of a marketing deal for them, not only in terms of spending money with them, but also to bring them on as a shareholder.
That's right. So what we sort of realized is, as much as, you know, once we had sort of broken that chicken and egg problem and had the taskers and the customers sort of, you know, interacting on the marketplace, we thought about, what does it take to scale the company? And so when Seven pitched us to come on board as an investor, they'd actually set up a Seven Ventures group. And so they came knocking on our door, and the opportunity there was to partner with them and to bring them on as a shareholder, where they would invest in the form of cash, of course, but also in terms of media contra. That was actually a really fruitful partnership for us, because we were looking at, you know, ways to be able to scale marketing anyway. So we were like, well, we're going to spend our money on marketing. But, you know, of course, what it did is it made us think, you know, we've got to spend the money with Seven as opposed to spending it with Google or Facebook or some other group. And that worked out really well for us, because as you build a marketplace, you're trying to build out trust in that marketplace. You need people to know that you're here to stay. You're not a fly-by-nighter. And I think TV, it was really suitable for that. And then second of all is you want to try and become like a household name, so that, you know, when somebody is, you know, has a leaking tap, they're just straight away, they're thinking Airtasker. When they have to move houses, straight away, they're thinking about Airtasker. That's really what the partnership with Seven allowed us to do, was to get, you know, into the mainstream of Australia, to be able to also put ourselves contextually. You know, we advertised a lot during like Better Homes and Gardens, and great part of our journey. And it was a huge step change, frankly, in the growth of the marketplace.
Those big media companies like Seven, like Channel 9, they were watching what was going on around the rest of the world, and the audience should take this on board because this applies to every media company. They were watching what was going on around the world, and there was this concept of convergence, that is converging media platforms with investment. So they give you media coupons and they give you cash. Cash, I guess, to develop your business, and the media coupons to build your brand. And I don't know, look, everyone keeps talking about digital marketing. Digital marketing is extremely powerful, don't get me wrong, particularly today, extremely powerful. But I still believe, even though the audiences have shrunk, the mainstream television stations are very good for building a brand. And as you said a very good point, household name. Households still watch television.
For sure.
They still watch the news. They still watch Better Homes and Gardens. They still watch whatever shows Channel 7 has and Channel 9 has. They still watch these shows. And I've always found that to be very good to launch a brand and very good to implant a brand or brand name into someone's head.
Oh, for sure. I think, you know, we saw something like 35% week-on-week growth, you know, we launched with seven. And we were already at a you know, sizable scale even before we went and did that. So it's definitely powerful. And I agree with you in relation to, you know, digital channels like, you know, YouTube and Google and Facebook versus, you know, free-to-air channels like 9 and 7 and things like that. If you go and speak to the folks at 7 and 9 20 years ago, they were probably over-hyping it, just like how YouTube and things are over-hyping it now. And I think that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you need to be able to make that choice about, you know, what's over-hyping versus what's actually real. And the answer is somewhere in between.
And then you IPO'd this year in 2021. In other words, you listed your business. What were the thoughts going through the mind around whether you should or you shouldn't do it, like in terms of timing or doing it at all?
Back in 2019, the journey to the IPO was a few years. In 2019, we were burning $2 million a month, and we made a decision, hey, we need to become a sustainable company that can pay its own way. In a very short period of time, because of the high leverage in our model, we were able to get profitable in 7 months. So we got profitable at the beginning of 2020. Then the pandemic hit. That was obviously disruptive, but actually caused a net acceleration in our business. And so by the end of 2020, we were like, hey, we want to move faster. We want to be able to like scale in the US and the UK. And, you know, we thought about like, how are we going to be able to raise the money to be able to do that? Because it is an upfront capital raising exercise to be able to go and launch new countries, et cetera. And so we thought, hey, if we do all this work up front, become a public company, we're going to have much more agile access to capital as a listed company. We also found that it was awesome to give our taskers and our employees an opportunity to own a piece of Airtasker, you know, to really own shares that they could sell and make money from. And so that was the other influence on going public. So we did that in March of this year. And we've already leveraged that by raising a round of capital a couple of months ago. And it was quite amazing. We were able to raise about $20 million to acquire a company in the US. And that took me about a week to be able to raise that sort of money. Whereas, you know, in terms of private capital, that would probably take you months.
If I was to take, and there's a whole lot of good stuff to take out of this, but I would take one thing out of this: develop the ability and the skill of being able to take people on your journey, whether it's the consumers, or whether it's the suppliers in your case, or the people who come to your marketplace, the people who actually provide the skills, or whether it's your shareholders, or whether it's your staff, whoever it is, develop the skill and the conviction of being able to take people on the journey with you. That's what I get out of this. That's incredibly powerful. And, you know, I might be out there giving advice to everybody else, but sometimes I forget these things myself, about things I should be doing or remember to do. So I appreciate this opportunity to hear this from you. I mean, I by the way, I've been asked lots of questions. Have you got a question for me?
I do have a question for you. So one of the things about being an entrepreneur or starting your own business is you obviously have to have enough conviction in what you're doing to go out and give it a crack. At the same time, it's always good to listen to people and gather advice and be open to other people's feedback and thoughts and stuff. Sometimes those two things can be like contradictory. How do you get a sense of when's the right time to be conviction? I'm going to go with what I believe versus I'm going to listen and maybe take on other people's advice.
It's a very good question, actually. This is going to sound a bit weird, but I once consulted an astrologist many, 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 many years ago, like maybe 10 years ago. I happened to be in Ireland at the time, and she was she's still a very famous astrologist in Ireland. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to give her pay her the 400 euros and she did this astrological chart for me. And one of the things she said to me was, you've got to be careful. You have a skill base in analytics. You know, you're an analytical person. Therefore, you want to listen to what everybody's got to say and you want to do your research. But she said, your astrological star sign says to you, always trust your gut, irrespective of the analytical research. And it's funny, I've always made the best decisions when I've gone on my gut reaction, what I feel inside my gut. The way I operate is that I do take in everybody's view. I listen to everybody's view, but I always ultimately make my call. I trust my own gut instinct at the end of the day. And I think that's because I'm 65 years of age and probably it's not a gut instinct. It's probably some sort of analysis going on in my brain from based on what I've seen over 40 odd years. And based on all the various people I've spoken to over all those years, my brain's probably arriving out at some sort of conclusion. So I do listen to everybody. I do take in what everybody's got to say. I generally speaking won't sit down and just accept what someone says in relation to what they're doing. I will want to test that. But ultimately, I make the call and I'm prepared to take the responsibility. I have experienced conflict, and when I have overthought it and overanalyzed it, I've made mistakes.
Yeah, I think having conviction as an entrepreneur and founder, it's actually easy to swing back the other way and start listening to other people too much. And yeah, I've definitely found that to be a challenge of like, how do I balance that? So sometimes just making the decision and having the conviction is powerful.
Yeah, totally. And if you're an entrepreneur, stick to conviction. Listen to everybody, but stick to conviction.
Awesome.
Tim Fung, that was awesome. I really enjoyed that. Thanks very much, mate.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for listening to The Mentor. Audio and production is by Jess Morley. And production assistants, Jonathan Leondis.